Thank you very much indeed, and it's a great pleasure to be here to do honor to the work of the John F. Kennedy Institute over the years, and especially to the work of its director, my, as you said, my very close and longstanding friend, Bud Collier. I thought perhaps, Bud, when I saw the calendar that you placed on this event, that you had decided to put me into competition with Senator Wendy Davis of the Texas legislature, who just a few days ago distinguished herself in history by staging a one-woman, 13-hour filibuster on behalf of women's health in Texas. But I report that I would not have been up to the challenge, and I'm glad that I don't have to face it. I have a letter on the wall of my study in Austin, Texas. It's dated, I think, around the 26th of January, 1961. And it reads, Dear Jamie, I understand that you were born in the last year of the last Democratic administration and are now about to celebrate your 9th birthday in these first 2 weeks of mine. I hope that the long Republican years have not hurt you too much, and that you will grow up to be at least as good a Democrat as your father, but possibly of a more convenient size. Yours sincerely, John F. Kennedy. So this occasion to speak at the John F. Kennedy Institute has a certain, as I say, special meaning for me. I was very pleased yesterday to be able to listen to Alan Trachtenberg and to hear him evoke certain themes in the American ethos: equality, democracy, the democratic partnership expressed in the verse of Walt Whitman. And I think it's perhaps not entirely coincidental that some of those themes will recur in a more prosaic form in what I have to say. Necessarily more prosaic, I am, after all, an economist. I gave the lecture a semi-serious title, but with a serious purpose, which was to call attention to the apparently negative relationship, negative correlation, if you will, between bandwidth and understanding in transatlantic communication. The benchmark for this thought is the age of the packet boat, the years just before the telegraph went online, as we would now say, at least on an enduring basis, in 1866. And my inspiration is the dispatch. My inspirations are the dispatches on the United States Civil War, which were prepared in London for the New York Tribune, but more frequently for Die Presse of Vienna, by a correspondent, what we might call today a pundit, by the name of Karl Marx. I don't know how many of you have had occasion to read Marx's analysis of the politics of the American Civil War, but it makes for very bracing reading, even today, especially given the 150 years of myth-making and obfuscation that have followed. It is a useful antidote to what is in the textbooks even now. Marx, for example, is very clear on the aggressive policy of the Southern states, who from the outset of the war were claiming what amounted to about 3/4 of all of the territory of the then United States, extending straight through across to the Pacific, would have been very happy to drive the boundaries of the surviving Union back to the borders of New England. He's exceptionally good going state by state through the balance of slave and free forces in each state, including especially the border states. He was alert to the geography, to the military topography of the region, to the importance of the railroad lines, and therefore from a very early point understood the centrality of Georgia and of Atlanta. Georgia is the key to secession. He is even quite good on what must seem to many an exceptionally arcane point, namely why Texas had never exercised its right under the Treaty of 1845 to divide itself into five separate states. Just to give you a little flavor of this, he wrote in 1861, "The South is not a country at all, but a battle slogan. The war of the Southern Confederacy is not a war of defense, but a war of conquest, a war of conquest for the spread and perpetuation of slavery," something that he documented with considerable care in these dispatches. And even on Texas, as I say, this is what he had to say, and I bring it here for a couple of reasons which will become apparent. He said, "A striking, even the actual slave states are not without oppositional elements. A striking example is Texas, with 180,388 slaves out of 601,039 inhabitants. The law of 1845 entitled it to form not merely one, but five states out of its territory. The South would thereby have gained 10 new votes instead of 2 in the American Senate. From 1845 to 1860, however, the slaveholders found it impracticable to cut up Texas, where the German population plays an important part, into even two states without giving the party of free labor the upper hand in the second state." And as someone who's now lived in Central Texas for almost 30 years, the fact that this is German territory is extremely well known. We have every culinary tradition that one could hope for, and the village of New Braunfels just down the road still has a newspaper that's called the New Braunfels Herald Zeitung. There is, in fact, at Fort Mabry, Camp Mabry, the headquarters of the Texas National Guard, one of the most obscure military monuments in the South, which is the monument to the Union forces that were recruited from the Germans who lived in Texas. Marx was also, of course, wonderful on Abraham Lincoln, and I won't quote the whole passage, but there's a little piece of it that describes Lincoln's style, the most redoubtable decrees flung by him at the enemy all look like and are intended to look like routine summonses sent by a lawyer to the lawyer of the opposing party. Captured, I think, very well what Lincoln was about, and wrapped up, in some sense, his feelings for the man in the letter of the International Working Men's Association sent on the occasion of Lincoln's re-election in 1864. Which begins famously, and I do make sure that all my undergraduates, who are not numerous in Texas, read this. "From the commencement of the titanic American strife, the working men of Europe felt instinctively that the star-spangled banner carried the destiny of their class." As a characterization, even then, of European consciousness of America, this is all unfair, of course. We vest Marx, or at least I do, with more reach in retrospect than he enjoyed at the time. Then, as now, and Marx himself makes the point, the Economist served to channel the establishment view, no doubt having already developed its famous method of operation, which I've heard summarized by people who work there as simplify, simplify, repeat, repeat. To the Economist in 1861, The war had nothing to do with slavery. It was a tariff question, never mind the fact that the tariffs in question hadn't been enacted until the war started. But the South, by God, stood for free trade, and that was the decisive principle so far as the economist was concerned. And then, as Marx himself notes, there was the ineffable Times of London, of which he writes. But now, consider the London press. At its head stands the Times, whose leading, this is just fantastic, whose leading editor, Bob Lowe, was formerly a demagogue in Australia, where he agitated for separation from England. It's wonderful. I mean, it just gives new meaning to the phrase, tout ça change, plus c'est la même chose. So let me pass abruptly to the present, to the prevailing caricature of America in Europe, and also to a degree to the prevailing caricature of Europe in America. These are twin perceptions, and a peculiar feature of them, I think, is that they serve the political purposes of both left and right on both continents. Thus, they are largely unchallenged, which is not the same thing as saying that they are accurate. America today, and for perhaps a generation, has projected itself in Europe as the land of the free market, of deregulation, of private enterprise, of flexible labor markets, of a weak welfare state, and this is celebrated in certain quarters as a formula for the great wealth of the United States, marred only by a certain unpleasant tendency to run big budget deficits and a shockingly loose monetary policy, neither of which quite fit the picture. Europe, on the other hand, is reflected back, particularly through the mass media in the United States, as a socialist paragon, laden with the oppressive presence of all-powerful trade unions, a cradle-to-grave welfare state, rigid wages and work rules, which are, of course, the reason for mass unemployment. In other words, a model for certain figures on the American left and an object of perpetual scorn for the right, and especially for the television personalities that one occasionally encounters talking about this subject. This American version of Europe is, of course, preposterous to anyone working in post-Hartz Germany, let alone looking for work or trying to feed a family in modern Greece. But likewise, the European vision of America would have been unrecognizable to the generation that built the modern American state and its prevailing institution, the generation, my father's generation, which spanned the period from the start of the Roosevelt administration in 1933 through John F. Kennedy's administration and that of Lyndon Johnson ending in 1969. With a certain amount of credit, in fact, going to the completion of the project in certain respects under Richard Nixon in the early 1970s. And I would like to argue that the caricature that I described remains fundamentally at odds with the reality in North America and the United States today. What, after all, was the New Deal? The New Deal was launched at a moment when there was a fundamental understanding that the previous model of economic activity had collapsed entirely. And beyond that, it represented a recognition that at least part of the United States had not advanced at all since the Civil War, in fact, had sunk ever more deeply into a miasma of poverty, malnutrition, illiteracy, and under development, that is to say, the states of the old Confederacy. And the New Deal launched a comprehensive assault on this twin phenomenon, the collapse of the overall system in the very recent past and the complete underdevelopment of the American South. Its initial phases were aimed at stabilization of prices and wages in agriculture and in industry. That's what the first acts of the Agricultural Adjustment Administration and the National Industrial Recovery Act were about. The stabilization of a financial sector which had to be purged and reorganized and restricted, which was done. It launched at a very early stage a project of construction across the country, but especially focused on the South. The Tennessee Valley Authority, which actually my father had a role in the siting of steel mills and later ammunition plants at places like Muscle Shoals in Alabama on the Tennessee River. The building of roads, of which 1 million kilometers were paved in the 1930s. My father, again, as a graduate student, drove from Cleveland on the south shore of Lake Erie, having taken the ferry across from Ontario, out to take up a graduate degree in Berkeley. And he took a Model T Ford and noted that the roads from Lincoln, Nebraska to the California line were not paved at that particular moment. There were about 1,000 airfields built under the New Deal. Every rural school in the country was reconstructed. And such major projects as the Lincoln Tunnel, the Triborough Bridge in New York, the Chicago waterfront, many others were taken. Conservation projects in which 1 billion trees were planted and the Conservation Service launched to deal with the Dust Bowl in the plains, parks, Civilian Conservation Corps, National Forests, and of course cultural support, including for writers like John Dos Passos and painters like Jackson Pollock and Willem de Kooning. The overall effect of the New Deal has been somewhat lost to history because of two prevailing myths, just as in fact there have been myths surrounding the true nature of the Civil War. It's amazing how quickly the myth makers get to work, but one of them is that it didn't really bring the unemployment rate down. This is false. The unemployment rate in 1933 was around 25%. By 1936, it was just below 10%. A dramatic reduction following 4 years of the most rapid growth in U.S. peacetime history. The misimpression on this point comes from the fact that there were no contemporary statistics, and subsequent historians who were mainly concerned with the private economy did not include the 3.5 million New Deal workers in the unemployment numbers. But these were a very significant piece of the workforce, and as far as they were concerned, if you were building the Lincoln Tunnel or the Triborough Bridge, you got up in the morning and you had a pretty decent job and you got paid for it. Right? The other myth, which continues to be repeated, including by some friends of ours whom I cannot succeed in correcting on this point, is that the Depression continued until the Second World War. It's absolutely untrue. Contemporaries understood very well that the Depression was over in March of 1933. And the subsequent years changed the mood of the country completely. A fact which is obvious to anybody who remembers that Franklin Roosevelt was reelected in 1936 with every state except for Maine and Vermont. What the war did was something else. It eliminated any residual unemployment. And it created a financial buffer, an American middle class, which had never previously existed in financial terms, which then carried the country forward into the post-war period. The third element in the New Deal was comprehensive social security, old age, survivors, and disability insurance all in one, unemployment insurance, minimum wage, collective bargaining rights through the Wagner Act, all of which were not considered to be luxuries created in a moment of wealth and triumph, but necessities to stabilize the position of the population in a moment of desperation and despair. A very important point, which I want to come back to later on. And if one then looks at the period that followed the New Deal, the New Frontier, the Great Society, one can see that they are actually just extensions of the New Deal project and carried out by people who were framed and brought up and trained under the New Deal. The Civil Rights Movement, the Civil Rights Act, and the Voting Rights Act, very sadly now vitiated by the Supreme Court, were intended to bring an excluded population, the black population, into the framework of institutions that the New Deal had created. There was a project going from Truman to through Obama to extend health insurance, major steps taken under Johnson in the creation of Medicare and Medicaid, and then finally, in fact, for that matter, I'll come to this under George W. Bush, and then finally under Obama, to, in a haphazard way, extend it to the whole population. And ultimately, a regulatory framework dealing with the environment, with safety, with consumer protections, and so forth, which crowned the Great Society and was continued to be implemented under Nixon. What was the role of John Maynard Keynes in all of this? Incidental, I would argue. He was a significant figure, but not an influence over American politics until, really until the 1960s. The new economics of my father's generation was a phenomenon of the Kennedy Council of Economic Advisors, not Eisenhower, not Truman, and only to a very limited extent, FDR. What was going on had its roots in an institutionalist and pragmatic tradition and also in a social democratic tradition, which again had its origins much more in what American scholars brought back from Germany in the late 19th and early 20th century. Was there then a Reagan revolution that overthrew all of this? I was there. I was the staff director of the Joint Economic Committee beginning in January of 1981. So I was on the in the trenches on the front lines with my little Molotov cocktails, tossing them at the Reagan tanks as they rolled up to Capitol Hill. And we had the opportunity to have practically, well, anybody from the administration to who we wanted to testify, generally speaking, were actually quite very good about accepting our invitation and sparring with us. But was there, in fact, such a revolution? The answer to that, in broad outline, is no. Reagan was, in many ways, a magnificent figure in American history. In his own professional tradition, which was screen acting, he was much better at the image than he was at the reality. And the reality under the image is, in some ways, a very interesting story. So while there were proposals and efforts to reverse the New Deal and the Great Society under Reagan, the actual changes were limited both in time and scope. George W. Bush made, I think, in many ways more serious efforts and under more complete control of the government, but he too was unable to destroy the most central institutions of the New Deal, in particular Social Security, and at one point, to the great dismay of true conservatives, Bush actually switched sides and put through the Medicare Part D, which is the drug program, the drug benefit, which was a very significant expansion of the state presence in the economy. Obama has extended it again. The relevant model here for modern American conservatism, therefore, is very far from that of Friedrich von Hayek or Ludwig von Mises, who presented a purely illusory picture of what could or should or would be done. I think the model, with all due respect to my own work, is the predator state. That is to say, the question of how much of what is channeled through public and parapublic institutions, including the nonprofit sector, gets siphoned off to oligarchs, cronies, and the, let's say, the richest constituents of whatever administration happens to be in power. And that issue, which constitutes the nub of actual politics in a modern state, actually in any modern state, but the United States is a particularly clear example of it, is of course deliberately obscured by the rhetorical appeal to free markets, which do not exist, cannot be located anywhere outside of perhaps secondhand bookshops and other incidental activities. And even they have to abide by fire codes, you may have noticed. So markets are hardly free. But as I say, could not exist in the modern world. We, in our generation of economists, were brought up with theories of regulation under which regulation had costs and it had benefits and you had to balance the two. And we projected that picture to the world. It's a totally misleading picture. And the reality is that in a world in which you don't have effective, autonomous, credible, trusted regulation, the market systems do not exist. Because people will not buy and use the products, the food which they believe to be contaminated, the electrical products that they believe will explode, the airplanes that they think will run into each other into the sky, in the sky. It is absolutely indispensable that there be a regulatory framework over just about everything. In one area, however, the predator state obtained a definitive upper hand in the 2000s in the regulatory sphere. Actually, there were many areas in which it made terrific advances and eroded the protections, in fact, that previously enjoyed. But the one area where it really obtained the dominant role is obviously the area of finance, and especially the area of housing finance, which had been, for 60 years in the United States, yet another carefully nurtured product of state policy. But here, deregulation under the Clinton administration, as I said, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, and the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which prevented the regulation of credit default swaps, among other things, and desupervision, a separate process whereby the regulatory authorities make it clear to the supervisees that they are, the police have left the beat, that there's nobody looking over their shoulders, that they are not going to enforce previously existing standards which remain on the books. That desupervision was made explicit in the early years of the George W. Bush administration, and what it produced is what you would expect it would produce, a disastrous decline in the quality of loans, a rise to monumental levels of fraud, all of which was rewarded by very high valuations in the capital markets for the companies involved, which became high flyers, and their owners therefore were able to get very rich. And ultimately, as is inevitable in a situation like this, when it becomes clear to the wider world what has happened, there was the collapse. And the collapse was a fundamental and definitive collapse of the U.S. financial sector. And as a result of the fact that the bad loans had been peddled assiduously to consumers in Europe, to investors, municipalities, pension funds, and banks, it there followed the inevitable panicky reaction on this continent, which is the precipitating event of the European financial crisis. Those frauds, while they were going on, served public policy purposes. They served the purposes of the incumbent state. That fact is clear on its face. The construction and the cash infused into the economy supported the measurement of economic, the measured rate of economic growth through 2006. Right? And it's clear from the fact that no one who was involved has been punished, prosecuted. It's obvious that we have an ongoing pattern of protection by the same state actors who were responsible for the debacle. At the same time, though, if you look at the prevailing public institutions in the United States as a whole, and especially the very remarkable scope of social insurance, unemployment, disability, food stamps, Social Security itself, as well as Medicare, Medicaid. It is clear that taken together, these were robust enough to prevent a final collapse of the economy on the scale of the 1930s, the enduring gift to our generation from especially Franklin Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson. In a few months in 2009, employment and output fell by 10% in the United States, and 8 percentage points of that were substantially replaced by rising public transfers. Right? A little bit of that was discretionary activity action by the Congress in passing the Expansion Act, the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. Most of it was automatic stabilization coming from the rise in Social Security payments and 70 million people on food stamps and people being accepted into disability and other programs of that kind. Much of that, as I say, happened within a few months of the disaster. I think that itself stands as fairly definitive evidence of the power of public institutions and a fairly definitive refutation of the idea that we have become a Hayekian free market economy in the years since Ronald Reagan. Now, how is all this different from what one observes in Europe? I think when one considers the overall track of economic performance in Europe, taking the continent as a whole and comparing it to the United States, the differences are not that extreme. It's true the European Central Bank has a much more restrictive charter, unlike that of the Federal Reserve. I didn't write the European Central Bank charter. I did write the Federal Reserves. True story, strange but true. But the European Central Bank in practice has acted as a central bank must act in this situation, charter or no charter. And while both regions experienced a very deep slump in 2009, considerable fiscal stabilization occurred in Europe afterwards, as it did in the United States. The deficits here and elsewhere in the major countries went up dramatically with a very similar effect. It's important to recognize that these deficits, much decried, are in fact the saline solution of the patient in the emergency ward. Okay? And it is not considered good medical practice to ration the saline solution. Okay? Very important and I think overlooked point. It's also true that in both regions there's been an ongoing crisis of high unemployment. And once again, the statistics are a bit misleading on this. Favorably to the United States, the European Union acknowledges an unemployment rate of around 25%, much higher in the southern and crisis countries. The United States acknowledges an unemployment rate that's now down in the 7.5% range, but when one buries a little bit into the statistics, you find that at least that many, again, are in the discouraged worker category, and the difference has a lot to do with the extent of unemployment insurance and the way in which the unemployment measure is calculated, and not so much to do with the performance of the economy. The U.S. has not improved its employment to population ratio one whit since the crisis in 2009. So neither region has recovered fully, and neither will. The difference is one between a stable low rate of growth and a unstable continuing rate of decline. Both regions are gripped by an ideology of austerity, with the difference that in the U.S. we have political gridlock, which has been much decried, but in fact works against the implementation of the most severe forms of austerity. So I'm all in favor of political gridlock because bipartisan comity and decision making would lead to much worse results. And the evidence for that is in Europe, where you have more efficient governments and a strong expression of powerful policy preferences by the Troika, which are far more destructive. There's also another difference, which I think is worth noting. And that's in the character of the underlying debts behind the debacles. In the U.S., these are substantially private because they are mortgage debts, right? And the mortgages are, to a large extent, non-recourse, meaning that if you walk away from your house, you also walk away from your mortgage. Mortgages are either amortized or they are defaulted on. Either way, in most cases, the debt simply goes away over time. And so as a result, U.S. household financial position, although individual households suffer enormous loss of wealth and security, their debt position does tend to improve with a simple lapse of time. But when the debts are sovereign, as they were in Latin America in the 1980s and as they are in Europe, that doesn't happen. The debts are simply rolled over until they are negotiated down. They are not paid because debts that cannot be paid will not be paid. And so the crisis in debt simply continues in Europe where it doesn't in the United States. And there's a second difference, which seems to me to be the critical one. And it has to do, of course, with the different political character of these two continents, which is that Europe has imposed on itself a constraint that the survival of the Eurozone and of the European Union depends on the survival and viability of each and every country within it. The collapse of Greece will entail the collapse of Portugal, and perhaps Ireland, and the collapse of those countries will entail an attack on Spain and then on Italy. This is a process which, once it gets underway, cannot be stopped. It's a process that has to do with the way in which these countries are oriented toward each other and toward the so-called credit markets. But it's also similar, I think, in historical reality to the fact that Yugoslavia could not survive the departure of one republic, Slovenia, and the USSR did not survive the departure of three very small republics, the Baltics. Things that happen on the periphery move very quickly toward the core. And that is a critical difference. I mean, you have had this experience to go back to the 1860s, the departure of South Carolina entailed the secession of the rest of the South in stages. How far away is that collapse? I was in Greece 10 days ago now. I was there the day that the government shut the public radio and television, ERT. It did it on 6 hours' notice. There was no consultation in cabinet, no discussion or vote in the parliament. Why was this done? It was done because the government had failed to complete a negotiation to sell the gas monopoly to Gazprom for 800 million euro. Why had it failed? Because Gazprom isn't a smart company. It does due diligence. And the Gazprom economist felt that the income base of the Greek population was not sufficient to support the projected revenues of the gas monopoly. What else do you need to know? Do you need to go to Athens and watch the old people prowling through the garbage bins looking for food? And people sleeping on the streets in large numbers? You don't have to do that. It's very depressing. Do you need to drive from the center of town to Piraeus and go past the miles and miles of empty storefronts, leavened only by the occasional chain pawn shop? Actually, there are lots of pawn shops. Greece is full of them at the moment. The fact is, this cannot be very far away under this situation. A collapse cannot be far off. The ERT shutdown then, it seemed to me, and it seemed to the Greek people, when I went to ERT in Thessaloniki and I went there to the headquarters in Athens in the middle of the night, it's a great scene, 2 days ago. It crossed a line. It crossed a line which is actually quite similar to this discussion that I was giving to the economist, thinking that the Civil War was a tariff war, in fact a war over slavery. It crossed a line between an argument over austerity and the confidence ferry and the restoration of credit, and to a line about the survival of democracy. ERT is a very flawed institution with not a big market share, but it's the only place in Greece that you have a nationwide public discourse about the politics of the country. Without it, there's nothing but Australian demagogues, right? And or perhaps the channel of the Orthodox Church. And what happened on those nights in Athens was, I think, remarkable because it wasn't a protest. What happened was that the population came out in large numbers to protect the journalists who went into the building and continued to do their job. And the trade union said, no, we're not going to cut off the electricity, and they kept the power on in the building. The phone lines were down, but that didn't matter. Have the internet. And the feed went out over the web, where it was picked up and shown all across Europe. So what had been, as I say, presented as an economic issue, was revealed to be a question of the survival of the most basic institutions of democracy. And this is having political consequences as we speak. One of the coalition partners in the Greek government has left. The majority of the government is down to 3 seats in a parliament of 300. Things are very unstable. An election could happen quite soon. And if the election happens, it will be basically, I think, a choice between a new coalition of parties on the left called Syriza and a neo-Nazi movement called Golden Dawn. And that becomes a very fundamental choice for everybody who's involved in the European project. I'm involved with proposals to, as a technical matter, try and rescue this situation. I don't want to make too much of them here, and perhaps I've already spoken for more than my allotted time. I think that some aspects of the United States experience that I've just talked about are useful to think about here. And that's quite different from suggesting that you import the American model, which is something I think is professional malpractice. What has to be done within the framework of European law and treaties to the extent possible, because there is no time to change them. And what has to be done has some dimensions that we can learn from American experience. You have to deal with the debts by mutualization or a bankruptcy process, and mutualization is probably the easiest way to do it legally. You have to deal with the failed banks, including those that are being handed off to oligarchs in places like Greece. And I would suggest you find a few bankers in Germany who are competent bankers and send them down to Greece and let them take them over. The Greeks will give them away. Right? You have to provide hope, investment, some employment. The European Investment Bank exists to do that. It's blocked at the moment, but it could be revived and put to use. And as a particularly important point, since I've dwelt on the question of the role of social insurance in the Depression, you have to take responsibility for the community as a whole and stabilize the incomes and the life prospects of the most vulnerable and desperate people. The elderly, the unemployed, the disabled, people whose pensions have been cut, who are squeezed between high taxes, high VAT, and high energy prices, and collapsing pensions and wages. That's the modest proposal. It's modest because it is designed to work within the framework of what presently exists in Europe and by time, not to solve all problems, but to deal with a problem which, as I say, is on the brink of being unmanageable. So to come back to the figure I evoked at the beginning, stabilize, that is Moses and the prophets. Thank you very much.